Tonight we're to have a talk by Duncan Cook entitled Christ's Utterances from the Cross. Duncan has asked that we preface his meeting with a reading from Luke's Gospel, chapter 23. Luke's Gospel, chapter 23, a reading from verses 26 to 48. It's now my pleasure to ask Duncan Cook to come forward and talk to you on the subject of Christ's utterances from the cross. Duncan.
My dear brethren and sisters, these utterances from the cross were made in public, in full view of the people come to watch developments. As Jesus had predicted to Nicodemus, as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. And so every word was distinctly heard by many witnesses. These things were definitely not done in a corner. The soldiers took charge of Jesus, who was led away through the city gate to the place of crucifixion. Exhausted from lack of food and sleep, physically and mentally abused, Jesus stumbled under the weight of the heavy cross. And so it was that a bystander, Simon from Cyrene, was made to carry the cross, walking behind the prisoner. Now, the first utterance recorded in this 23rd chapter of Luke, strictly speaking, it was not from the cross, but the utterance came while the cross was being carried. And it was in response to the large number of people who joined the procession. So we read again from verse 27 of this 23rd chapter of Luke. And a great multitude of the people followed him, Jesus, and women who also mourned and lamented him. But Jesus, turning to them, said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For indeed the days are coming in which they will say, 'Blessed are the barren, wombs that never bore, and breasts which never nursed.' Then they will begin to say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if they do these things in the green wood, what will be done in the dry?" We notice that Jesus does not indulge in self-pity. He does not bemoan his lot. He's not giving vent to his anger at the injustice of the treatment he received. His concern was for the crowds following, their ignorance of what he knew the future held. The second utterance is recorded among the various Gospels. We're going to go to the account in Matthew chapter 27. Matthew chapter 27, reading at verse 33. "And when they had come to a place called Golgotha, that is to say, place of a skull, they gave him sour wine mingled with gall to drink. But when he had tasted it, he would not drink." As Brother Roberts writes in Nazareth Revisited, They offered their noble victim a mixture of drink, which, it is said, would have had the effect of dulling sensitivity to pain. Whatever feeling prompted their kindness, it was in vain. Jesus refused the drink. He would not assuage by a mechanical stupefaction the sufferings which the Father had called upon him to go through by the power of faith. Jesus' determination to be obedient to the burden laid upon him. This had been apparent just a few hours before when he prayed in the garden. As we read in the previous chapter, Matthew chapter 26, at verse 39, he went a little further and fell on his face and prayed, saying, O my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. In verse 42, a second time he went away and prayed, O my Father, if this cup cannot pass away from me, unless I drink it, your will be done. And he came and found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. So he left them, went away again, and prayed the third time, saying the same words. But we can be sure that the words of the Messianic 69th Psalm were very much in his thoughts. You know my reproach, my shame, my dishonour. My adversaries are all before you. Reproach has broken my heart, and I am full of heaviness. I looked for someone to take pity, but there was none, and for comforters, but I found none. They also gave me gall for my food, and for my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink. Brother Harry Whittaker comments, whatever its purpose, by contrast with the vinegar offered to him late in the day, now when he had tasted, he would not drink. The wording suggests that Jesus was glad enough to take this drink that was put on his lips, but when the first taste of it told him what its purpose was, he would not have it. The cup which my Father have given me, shall I not have it? Shall I not drink it? And to have faced crucifixion and death in a state of stupefaction would have been, in a sense, to have turned away from the cup which his Father now held out to him. In any case, there yet remained work, his Father's work, to be done, as the Gospels abundantly demonstrate, and for this a clear mind was necessary. The third utterance is recorded in Luke chapter 23. This was after the soldiers had set the cross upright with the title in three languages displayed above, as Pilate had insisted. By now the full weight of his body was suspended by the nails, and Jesus now experienced excruciating pain from which there would be no relief. And so, reading again from Luke chapter 23, at verse 32, there were also two others, criminals, led with him to be put to death. And when they had come to the place called Calvary, there they crucified him, and the criminals, one on the right hand and the other on the left. Then Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. and they divided his garments and cast lots. And the people stood looking on. But even the rulers with them sneered, saying, "He saved others, let him save himself, if he is the Christ, the chosen of God." The soldiers also mocked him, coming and offering him sour wine and saying, "If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself." It's clear that Jesus understood full well the reason for his sufferings. They were necessary for the discipline of trial. It's Paul who invites us to consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin, and you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens and scourges every son whom he receives. It is in the context of this contradiction of sinners set against him that Jesus asks his Father to forgive them. He realized that they said and did these terrible things in ignorance. They did not know what they were saying. Remember how Peter later informed his countrymen, "The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of our fathers, glorified his servant Jesus, whom you delivered up and denied in the presence of Pilate when he was determined to let him go. But Peter says you denied the Holy One and the Just and asked for a murderer to be granted to you and killed the Prince of Life whom God raised from the dead, of which we are witnesses. Yet now, brethren, I know that you did it in ignorance, as did also your rulers. But those things which God foretold by the mouth of his prophets that the Christ would suffer, he has thus fulfilled." The fourth utterance follows on from the third utterance in Luke chapter 23. And we're able to see a connection with the sign put over the middle cross relating to the King of the Jews. So reading on in this 23rd chapter at verse 38, it speaks of an inscription which was written over him in letters Greek, Latin, and Hebrew, "This is the King of the Jews." Then one of the criminals who were hanged blasphemed him, saying, "If you are the Christ, save yourself and us." But the other, answering, rebuked him, saying, "Do you not even fear God, seeing you are under the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we receive due reward of our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong." And then he said to Jesus, "Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus said to him, "Assuredly I say to you today, you will be with me in paradise." Now clearly the penitent thief understood perfectly the role of Jesus as a king. And this was central to Jesus' defense at his trial before Pilate. You remember how when Pilate entered the praetorium again, he called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" And Jesus answered him, "Are you speaking of yourself about this, or did others tell you this concerning me?" Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you to me. What have you done? Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight, so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here. Pilate therefore said to him, are you a king then? And Jesus answered, you say rightly that I am a king. For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness of the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. It is a mistake to think that the penitent's understanding of Jesus' role in this coming kingdom came late in the day. For over 3 years, Jesus had been preaching the gospel of the kingdom. He had been preaching about his own central role in that kingdom. And it seems very likely that the thief had earlier himself responded to Christ's teaching. Now hanging alongside the middle cross with the title of the accused displayed above, the thief publicly affirms his belief in that kingdom. And when we think about it, it must have been so reassuring for Jesus to know that alongside him was a believer, someone sympathetic to his mission, one day to rule. Now we know that the popular view is that Jesus was promising instant reward in heaven. But that cannot be, because we know that Jesus was 3 days in the grave. He didn't ascend into heaven to be alongside his Father for another 40 days. And in Hebrew, paradise is a garden. We think of the Garden of Eden. And the paradise restored on earth is future. Hence the promise to the church in Ephesus, I will give to him who overcomes to eat of the tree of life, which is in the paradise of God. The fifth utterance is recorded in John chapter 19, and it concerns provision for his mother Mary, soon to be bereaved. So we read from John chapter 19, verse 25. Now there stood by the cross of Jesus his mother and his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Cleopas, and Mary Magdalene. When Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing by, he said to his mother, woman, behold your son. And then he said to the disciple, behold your mother. And from that hour, that disciple took her to his own home. We're reminded of the prediction made by Simeon. He lived long enough to see the Lord Christ taking him up in his arms to bless the child. We're told that Joseph and his mother marveled at those things which were spoken of him. Then Simeon blessed them, said to Mary his mother, behold, this child is destined for the fall and rising of many in Israel, and for a sign which will be spoken against. Yes, a sword will pierce through your own soul also, that the thoughts of many hearts may be revealed. And Mary never forgot Simeon's prediction of the tragic end in prospect for her firstborn son, which would cause her so much pain and grief. It has been suggested that after the disciple John had watched Jesus being nailed to the cross, he went and fetched Mary from inside the city so that she could witness the end. Her son's thoughtfulness for his mother's future, safely committed to the care of the disciple John, that thoughtfulness must have meant so much to the grieving mother. As Melva Purkis in his book A Life of Jesus beautifully writes, he says, "Two hearts sought each other in the growing darkness. A heart bleeding from a sword thrust found strength in the kinship of a disciple who loved. A heart breaking with grief found solace in a solemn trust, and from that hour that disciple took her into his own house." In the final week, John's Gospel recalls before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And that is self-evident in this fifth utterance from the cross. And when we remember his agony at the time, then Jesus' thoughtfulness, love for his mother, is really astounding, isn't it? A love he continues to show to all his brothers and sisters who are part of the body of his church. So we read from Mark chapter 15. Mark chapter 15, verse 33. Now when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. It's interesting that Blunt, in his book Undesigned Coincidences, notes how the mockery of the hostile members of the crowd, and also the soldiers, was silenced by the unnatural phenomenon of the darkness. We quote, "Is not this change of conduct in the merciless crew that surrounded the cross very naturally explained by the awe with which they contemplated the gloom as it took effect? And does it not strongly, though undesignedly, confirm the assertion that such a fearful darkness there actually was?" So, we read on, Mark chapter 15, verse 34. "And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which is translated, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And some of those who stood by, when they heard that, said, "Look, he's calling for Elijah." Then someone ran and filled a sponge full of sour wine, put it on a reed, and offered it to him to drink, saying, "Let him alone. Let us see if Elijah will come and take him down." It seems that bystanders mistook the word Eloi for Elijah, and so they missed the obvious connection with the messianic 22nd psalm, because Jesus appropriates the passage to his own present situation. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me? and from the words of my groaning. O my God, I cry in the daytime, but you do not hear, and in the night season, and am not silent. This sixth utterance from the cross is another example of Jesus' focus on the fulfilment of Scripture. That Jesus was able to recall such passages as Psalm 22 as he hung in agony on the cross shows the depth of his knowledge of events described in advance in the Old Testament. Brother Robert's comments in Nazareth Revisited, some have a difficulty in understanding such words from the mouth of Jesus. There need be none. The exhaustion of nature accounts for the momentary suspension of understanding. Consider the sleepless and terrible night he had come through, the buffetings, the scourging, and the 6 hours' fiery agony on the cross. Can we wonder at strength gone, understanding clouded, and heart broken? The fullest account of the seventh utterance on the cross is in John's Gospel. If we just turn forward to John chapter 19. John chapter 19, reading at verse 28. After this, Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished, that the scripture might be fulfilled, said, I thirst. Now a vessel full of sour wine was sitting there, and they filled a sponge and with sour wine, put it on hyssop, and put it to his mouth. So when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, it is finished. And bowing the head, he gave up the spirit. This time, it is Jesus himself who cries out, I thirst. And receiving the sour wine was his last act before passing away. And to these words, we can read the final eighth utterance as recorded by Luke. Then the sun was darkened, the veil of the temple was torn in two, and when Jesus had cried out with a loud voice, he said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. And having said this, he breathed his last. These utterances we have been considering are Christ's last words on the cross. It's very interesting to think that his very first recorded words were spoken as a 12-year-old, when his parents found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, both listening to them and asking them questions. And we're told, when they saw him, they were amazed, and his mother said to him, Son, why have you done this to us? Look, your father and I have sought you anxiously. And he said to them, Why did you seek me? Did you not know that I must be about my father's business? But they did not understand the statement which he spake to them. And so doing his father's business had always been Jesus' priority. And so it is that his last words from the cross, it is finished, acknowledges that that objective had now been achieved. But the path had been rough, difficult. From his agony in the garden, from standing trial before Herod and Pilate, from being made sport of by cruel soldiers who mocked his claims, now at the end, he commits his life into his Father's hands. So it is marvellous to see the consistency of his life, always spent in doing his Father's business. Having set his face like a flint to go up to Jerusalem for the last time, he was resolute to the end. A final quote from Nazareth Revisited: "The tempest of grief and anger that sweeps over the soul in contemplation of these things finds its counterpart in the manifestation that now struck terror into the spectators. An earthquake sent its appalling tremors far and wide, with sharp cracking sound. The rocky hills in the neighbourhood of Jerusalem were rent asunder in all directions. The graves were exposed. The veil of the temple that fenced off the holiest from human intrusion, that veil was sharply torn open from top to bottom. Dark, weird, and terrific, every aspect of nature combined to express the anger of God at the tragedy which, while his own prearrangement for high and holy ends, was nonetheless the infamous triumph of human wickedness over the holy, good, and divine." Well, we've seen that we have four accounts of the crucifixion, and it's not at all easy to plot the actual sequence of Christ's various utterances from the cross. But nevertheless, we are given sufficient to establish faith, sufficient for us to appreciate his saving work. And that we may believe, John sums up as the point of his gospel: "Truly, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name."